Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a Provention Connection web conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Mr. David Lee. Mr. Lee, you may begin.
Thank you very much, and welcome to today's web dialogue, The Workplace, a dialogue on organizational practices to prevent violence against women. I am happy to be here with, as part of the team at the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, who puts on Provention Connection, and I'd like to introduce one of my colleagues at Provention Connection, Ellen Ian Wyckoff. So, Ellen?
Thank you, David. Welcome, everyone. We appreciate you folks joining us this morning or this afternoon, depending on what part of the country that you're from, on the Provention Connection web conference. Just to tell you a little bit about Provention Connection and introduce some of the members of the team, we have Chad Smithson and Amy Loya. Amy is also on the call and are on the web conference with us. And in terms of some of the key staff with Provention Connection, obviously many of you may know David Lee, who's the project manager for this project. And you may see a little picture of us and our contact information on the slide right above you. So David, okay, thank you for the next slide. Provention Connection, basically what we do through Provention Connection is we provide a variety of different services. First of all, we have the podcast and online presentations and also the wiki. We'll probably be giving you some more information, or if you go onto our website, you'll get more information on how you can get into or access the various podcasts, online presentations, and the wiki. The other thing that we offer is also the Provention Connection listserv. I hope that many of you are on it. If you're not, if you'd like to join this listserv, that where you can connect and network outside of web conferences, please feel free to sign up on our Provention Connection website. The other thing that, as many of you are participating today, one of the other services that we provide is the web conferences and the web dialogue. And so that's something that we do offer on a pretty frequent basis, and you can get more information through our website. The other thing that we offer on the Provention Connection website is all the materials and archives of the previous web conferences and web dialogues and events. So again, the web our website is probably the best way for you to access that information.
Hey, thank you, Ellen. Let's talk a little bit about the wiki, just to be able to highlight this is a new project at Provention Connection. And I'm really excited to be able to do this wiki. A wiki is like Wikipedia. It's a forum where people who are participating in Provention Connection's activities can add information to build the collective knowledge of the work done in violence against women prevention, done from people from the field, where people like all of the participants today can add and edit each other's thoughts to really build the best knowledge about how to be able to do violence against women prevention work. I strongly encourage you to go check out our wiki, which you can get on preventconnect.org. And if you want to be able to join, set up a user account so you can be able to add and edit messages on here, like Wikipedia, but dedicated to the issues of violence against women prevention. So I really want to encourage you to be able to use that function. I want to let you know that our next web conference will be on September 19th, and this will be looking at the intersection of preventing violence against women and ending oppression. And we are excited about this web conference that will be held to be able to explore how to address those issues, looking at the root causes to be able to indeed make effective social change. The web registration will open on the week of August 27th. All people who registered for this conference will receive notification about that email. This, as usual, is a free web conference. Please sign up quickly because this one, I expect, will fill up very quickly. I do want to highlight a few issues about how to use some of the technology that we have in our web conference. That in this web conference, many of you have, most of you should have attended before, but some of you might not be as familiar with this work. There's several features we want to highlight. The first one I want to highlight is the raise hand feature. If you look above my picture on the screen, on the left-hand side, there's a hand which is just circled. Can you, everyone, please raise your hands? We'll just practice raising hands. Great. I see that a large number of you, about half of you, have raised your hands, and now a little bit more than half. This is a feature that we will be using during this web conference to be able to get sometimes asked questions. Another feature that I want to be able to highlight is that you will be able to see the names of all the participants, and that's below the picture, and it's a good way to have a sense of who else is participating in these sessions. Also, I want to let you know that we have the text chat function that many of you have been using. The text chat is an opportunity to be able to have more discussion, and we'll be doing several brainstorms in that text chat, so I want to encourage you to use that. You also have a feature that we can use called questions and answers. And this is a feature where we are able to ask questions to learn more about who the audience is. I'm going to just ask a few questions so we can get a sense of who this audience is today. First question that I'm asking is, what is the best description of your organization? Number one, if you are a sexual assault or domestic violence agency or coalition, click one. Two, if you're from a business, click 2. 3, from a college or university-based program. Number 4, if you're from a local, state, or public health organization. And 5 is if you are something other. So let's learn a little bit about who the audience is who's participating today.
And David, we're not seeing that on our screen.
That would only be on the screens of the not presenters won't see it, but other people should be seeing that. So thank you. I see that many of you have responded to this, and some people are writing it in the text chat. Let me just share the quick findings of where we have what we've seen, that we see that over 50% of people, 57%, are from sexual assault or domestic violence agencies. We do have some people that are from businesses, about 5%, another 5% from colleges or universities, 16% from colleges or universities, and 17% other. I just want to get a little sense of how many people have participated. This is a follow-up to our previous web conference on organizational change practices, but I do want to know how many of you have attended a web conference before. So, one, yes, you have attended a previous web conference, and two, no, this is your first time you've attended a Prevention Connection web conference. So go ahead and fill in those questions. And I see that we quickly got 100 people responding, and we are moving forward. Well, this is great to see. I'm going to share the results with you all to let you know that it's about 50-50. 51% of you have attended a previous one, and indeed 48% of you, this is your first Prevention Connection web conference, so welcome. I hope you join us in the future. I do strongly recommend that you look at our session on organizational practice that we had done that's linked on the website to be able to get some of the background of this conversation. We will be doing a brief summary today. I'm now going to close the questions that we have, and I want to be able to now let you know that if you have any problems on the web, please send us a private text chat. I know some people are still waiting to get online with the phone. You can also call Island Technical Assistance at 800-799-4510, and that you also could contact CalCASA at 888-922-5227, and Amy will be able to help you over there. Ellen, can you talk a little bit more about what Prevention Connection does?
Well, basically, thank you, David. Basically, what Prevention Connection, we focus on issues related to prevention and violence against women. And so basically, what I'd like to talk about is what do we mean about violence against women? And so what you see on your screen is just kind of highlighting the various topics that we would address in terms of and what we mean by violence against women. First of all, we mean domestic violence, sexual violence, violence across the lifespan from like children or from a child up to elders, preventing violence before it starts, and connecting to other forms of violence. And so why don't we move on to the next slide, David? And so the other thing that we wanted to do was also acknowledge the various collaborative partners that we work with through Prevention Connection. We work with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. We also work with the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, PREVENT, which is the project that's preventing violence through education, networking, and technical assistance out of the University of North Carolina, and also VAWNET, the National Online Resource Center on Violence Against Women, out of the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Domestic Violence. The other thing that we wanted to highlight is that Prevention Connection is sponsored by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this listserv and the web conferences do not necessarily represent the official views of the U.S. government, CDC, or CalCASA.
Okay.
Thank you, Ellen, very much. And what I'd like to do now is move into our session, and we have some very exciting speakers. So what I'm going to do is hand over to be facilitating today's session from Prevention Institute is Liz Waiters and Larry Cohen. So Larry and Liz, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Thanks very much, David. Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's forum. We're going to focus on the workplace and really talk about organizational practices that can prevent violence against women. I'm joined today, I'm Larry Cohen, and I'm joined by Liz Waiters, who works here with me as the program director in violence prevention.
Hi, everybody. This is the third dialogue that we've hosted on organizational practice changes to prevent violence against women. The last two dialogues focused on organizational practices in the workplace in general and the healthcare sector in particular to shift norms that contribute to violence against women. This is the first Prevention Connection web forum that I've hosted, and I'm really happy to be a part of this groundbreaking discussion. I'm really happy also to be here with Larry, David, and all of our incredible guest speakers and all of you.
And I think today, Liz, is going to be pretty unique, not only because it's your first forum, but because of what we've got planned for a dialogue where we're going to look at really how do we start to craft for the nation effective models of primary prevention of violence against women in the workplace. We realize this is such a new and emerging field that there really aren't any complete models out there to highlight. So we decided to take this time to really bring everyone in, but with a very focused panel where we can have a discussion on what a workplace should look like to support primary prevention of violence against women. Maybe could you review the agenda?
Definitely. Okay, what we're going to do first is talk briefly about the context for today's discussion. Then we're going to introduce our four guests and find out a little bit about the work that they're doing. After that, we're going to move into a fishbowl discussion among the guests, myself and Larry, and we're going to create a vision that workplaces for what workplaces should look like within a primary prevention frame. After that, we're going to open up the discussion to questions and comments from the audience, and finally, we'll end with an evaluation.
So, of course, our learning objectives, you know, are based on doing this hard thinking about what the role of the workplace is, and then to delineate the barriers and, more importantly, the next step to creating workplaces in which we have norms that support positive, healthy relationships and positive, healthy treatment of women. As always, we'll also be experimenting with the use of technology. So maybe, Liz, do you want to give a brief definition as I bring us to slide 13 of prevention?
Exactly. Thanks, Larry. Okay, this is going to be how we frame the entire discussion today. So as we go throughout this and you're listening, I want everyone to keep in mind that primary prevention focuses on taking action before violence occurs. And we distinguish primary prevention from intervention and after-the-fact responses, such as, if you can advance to the next slide, thanks, to secondary and tertiary responses. So today our focus is going to be on what can workplaces do, what kind of policies and practices need to be in place to prevent violence against women before it occurs.
So I think one thing that's really important about prevention, you know, I did a video a number of years ago called Beyond Brochures. What's important about prevention, it's not just telling people. It's really a systematic response, and that's where kind of the notion of what we can do in the workplace takes place. It's not just talking about violence, and it's certainly not talking about the violence after it occurs, though that is very, very important. It's saying, how do we systematically think about this before? So maybe perhaps why don't we have a brief text chat and ask the question, and please text it in at the bottom, what would your workplace look like if it were contributing to the primary prevention of violence against women? Think about the violence and say, what kind of workplaces would make it less likely for violence against women to occur?
And while we're texting in and reading this, Larry's going to go through some of the norms that we are thinking about in terms of environmental change.
Let me just give people a minute, and let's just see what some of the text chat information looks like, and then as you say, I'll be happy to do that.
Great.
We're seeing equality in pay, hiring, anti-harassment policies, support of equal fair, non-hierarchical, non-violent language, environments that promote open communication, equal wages for women and men, agencies with domestic violence prevention, respect, transparency, that's an interesting word, a more flat organization, or maybe Cheryl means a completely flat organization, policies to assist DV victims, and it's interesting to think about how that also contributes not only after the fact, but the ways in which it might contribute to primary prevention, no intimidation, respect of diversity. So those are some of the issues, as people keep text chatting in, those are some of the issues that I think we'll be discussing later on in our fishbowl discussion with our four guests and really try and hone in more. But one thing we found when we talk about organizational practices generally is we're most effective, Liz, when we really can try and be very, very specific. And so we're going to talk just briefly a reminder of the five key norms that come up when we're talking about violence against women and the norms that we probably can focus in on in the workplace. And then we'll also be specific about some of the places, the types of things that workplaces do. And where, you know, some specific opportunities, whether it be in training or hiring or in decisions about pay and so forth. So let me go through these with you, Liz. And first, just the notion that violence is the way we solve our problems.
Yes. This notion is that violence is everywhere. Boys will be boys. You know, we live in a violent culture, that things have always been this way. It's going to take a long time to change. That's the norm of violence.
And it plays out then, and as you say, boys will be boys.
Exactly.
Certainly in my experience, in my environment, I was told that, you know, there are certain ways I should behave, and clearly those are not ways that support prevention of violence against women.
The second norm that we have is the norm of traditional masculinity, which ties into that, as Larry was saying, boys will be boys, everything is violent. We see a reflection of the norm about male behavior and masculinity, for example, in the toys that boys are encouraged to play with, or in the manner in which boys are socialized, as Larry said, to not cry or to not show emotion. In workplaces, the norms about traditional masculinity also have repercussions on perceptions of femininity and the limited roles for women, which moves us into the next norm, limited roles for women.
And you know, there's a study just came out that showed that when women negotiate for higher salaries, they are not as well liked and may be less likely to get the job than a man. That's very interesting because so many of the people were just text chatting in that equal salary is a critical issue, and yet we see it has this inappropriate negative repercussion. And I'm sure many of you have heard it probably ties in to the notion that assertive behavior by men is being, assertive behavior toward men is being perceived as overly aggressive behavior when it's the same behavior by women.
Exactly. The next norm is that of power and control. The value that we place on claiming and maintaining power is also manifested as power over others. Violence against women isn't therefore just about male dominance over women. It's also about other forms of power over others. That includes, for example, people with legal immigration status holding it over those without legal immigration status, or adults holding power over younger people.
And the final norm, in some ways, I think, may be the most powerful in terms of immediate change. It's the norm that violence is a private matter. It's none of our business. Silence is the way to deal with it. And so the notion of getting employers to understand that violence against women and prevention, not just identification, but prevention of violence against women is their business, and in fact will pay off in how it impacts worker productivity, absenteeism, healthcare costs, workplace
safety. Exactly. And many of our guest speakers today, you'll find out, they have dealt exactly with the norm of privacy and getting workplaces to realize that it is their business. For example, the norm of silence plays out in situations where employees might not be comfortable or feel empowered to speak out against objectionable workplace practices. A Cafe Press example just came up to us recently, where Cafe Press is an organization that prints T-shirts with anything people ask for. Recently, they had a number of shirts for sale, Larry, with no means no on it.
That's cool. That's great.
Yeah, except for here, no means things like give me another drink. Now, of course, this is about how products, about the products and that are being sold to the outside, but this obviously has implications for workplaces, the people who have to deal with these T-shirts, the people, the women and men, who have to actually put these logos on the T-shirts.
And, you know, it's the whole thing. I mean, it's kind of, you know, somebody would look at probably a frustrated response by me to the T-shirt, and they say, oh, where's your sense of humor?
Exactly.
And this issue of lack of sense of humor has really been used against women and against the men who really stand up for safety for women. You know, one of the ways to address environmental change, as people were saying in the text chat, is to look at some of the attitudes and behaviors. Here's this boardroom picture, you know, because workplaces are where we spend a large part of our time. You know, they so much influence what we take for granted in terms of attitudes and behavior.
And so in that sense, changing workplace practices and policies to create environments that contribute to primary prevention of violence against women can have a significant impact on all of us and the work that we do.
And so the prince shared his deepest feelings, encouraged her in her own career, and they lived happily ever after. Pretty unusual fairy tale, I would say.
But if this comes to fruition, issues like differing perceptions and outcomes for women and men negotiating for higher salary, for example, won't be as big an issue as it is today.
Yeah, but him standing there with, or sitting there with his arms crossed. Yeah. So we've said it in other web forums, but I know half the people here seem to be new. The Spectrum of Prevention, a tool I created probably now 2 decades ago, actually for a video called Beyond Brochures, it's a tool to really look at how do we change norms, how do we focus broadly, and today obviously on that fifth level, the level of changing organizational practices. But all the levels kind of play off one another. Changing organizational practice requires educating some of the business owners, individual knowledge and skills in some cases may require policy and legislation. But we'll get into all of that a little later. But this is something we've created that Liz and I thought would be really helpful today, which is a list of organizational functions. Because the question, what do we do in a business, kind of sounds general, kind of sounds vague. When we look at these 8 places where we can do something, we feel like then we can be more specific about how to have an impact.
Exactly. And what we want to do as we go throughout the rest of this program is think about how we can make changes in these particular functions in a way that address the 5 norms that contribute to violence against women.
So, you know, we're really privileged today to be joined by a diverse group of people who are some of the lead thinkers on violence against women in the workplace. They're going to help us think about this topic today. I just want to say that the task we're giving for all of ourselves isn't that easy because, as I said, there are no exact models. But all of our guests deal with workplace issues from a variety of perspectives.
Exactly. After our fishbowl discussion with our guests, we're going to open up the dialogue to everyone. But right now, the aim of today's discussion is going to be visionary as opposed to reactionary, which means that we really want to create that vision of what primary prevention in workplaces would look like and figure out what's needed to actualize that vision as opposed to just focusing on the after-the-fact interventions and policies.
So what would we want all workplaces to look like? Liz, perhaps you'd like to introduce the guests.
Yes, I would. I've had the pleasure of talking with each of our four guests, and I'm really excited to have them on live now. We have with us Kim Wells of the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence, Douglas Leach of Blue Shield Against Violence, Blue Shield Foundation of California, Johnny Lee of Peace at Work in North Carolina, and Keisha Pollack of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Maryland.
So, Kim, why don't we start with you since your picture is the top left picture. What's the Corporate Alliance to End Partner Violence?
Well, what we are, good afternoon, everyone, is a nonprofit organization that was actually founded by businesses to address domestic violence as a workplace issue. And we are the first national organization of our kind created by businesses specifically to address the issue. Interestingly enough, it started out actually because the founding corporate member, State Farm, got in a little hot water for not writing life and health insurance for victims of domestic violence because, as you all may well know, victims of domestic violence get sick and they die, which makes them a bad risk. And as State Farm started kind of looking around and realizing that that wasn't a good underwriting policy and changed their policy, they started to realize that that was a bad issue and a large cost for their insureds, it was probably a large cost for their 70,000 employees. And if that was a large cost for their 70,000 employees, the same was true for the other large businesses that they did business with and other businesses. And they thought, you know, not only could we save some money, not only could this make a difference, this could perhaps make a difference in society and how people look at the issue of domestic violence. And so they formed this organization. And so really, I think what's been an interesting sort of sea change for us from a cultural, maybe primary prevention issue and a macro level is to see the question change from the business community from why should I do something about this to I know I should do something about this and what is it that I should do? And I see I have a question, how is State Farm able to define victim of domestic violence as a background check process when they saw things in medical files, the underwriters saw things that indicated the person was a victim of domestic violence because that's what was in a medical file, then they wouldn't underwrite. So thank you for that question.
Wow.
That's a very good question.
Thanks, Kim.
You bet. I love the chat as well. And so, you know, kind of looking from all of the spheres, I think sometimes we only think about domestic violence impacting a victim, but we want people to realize you've got victims working for you, you have batterers working for you. Coworkers are impacted, family members that care about those victims and those batterers are also working, and they're distracted, and that makes a difference. That's productivity, absenteeism, presenteeism, healthcare, and workplace safety for everybody.
But you're
so,
starting,
I'm sorry?
You're really starting to get into some of the gist of what we'll focus on a little bit later. I think that's an excellent place to start. Can we then, Douglas, hear
sure.
from you? Douglas?
Yes, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us.
Can you describe what you do with Blue Shield Foundation of California, Blue Shield Against Violence?
Sure. I run a program that's exclusively focused on workplaces and other organizations in California, and we are putting into practice something based on our own experience, which was back in the mid-90s, like so many other the folks out there, we had an incident where an employee was killed at Blue Shield. In response to that, our CEO and COO, both of whom were involved in California with shelters, went to the public affairs arm and said, can you help us devise a program that will train our employees and help us respond to this issue? And out of that grew a workplace training program. At first, the program was offered to Blue Shield customers and clients, and then became part of the foundation and now is offered to any California employer or organization throughout the state, and we offer workplace consultation and training. So that's, we're putting into practice as a business what we learned. And the foundation has three program areas, one of which is domestic violence. So we fund all the shelters in the state, we fund programs in the state, and we operate this one program, which is to bring the message to California employers. And really doing that is because we focus on the issues for the business. The impact, of course, is on the victim, but we focus on the issues for the victim, I mean for the business, in terms of performance, productivity, and all of those things. So that's a little bit about us.
Thank you very much, Douglas. I think that the way to do that and the interplay between a lot of the intervention and treatment kind of work you support and primary prevention is something I'm anxious to get into in a little while. But next, Johnny, what is Piece of Work?
Sure. First, I want to say thank you for everyone who's attending this. I sure appreciate this opportunity. Piece of Work is a nonprofit agency that's dedicated to violence prevention in and through the workplace. Although we address other forms of violence like the disgruntled employee and hostile clients, our main focus has been domestic violence in the workplace, primarily doing speaking engagements and training programs delivered to professional associations like your Society of Human Resource Managers, Safety and Health, ASIS, the Security Association, Employee Assistance Programs. I call that, well, when we go to them. We also do programs where they have them come to us, and we hold open enrollment seminars and conferences across the country. We always do this in conjunction with the local shelter or with the statewide coalition or maybe a Seroptimist group to make sure that it's a collaborative effort. From there, we've had these opportunities to do exposure to the companies, and we've had the opportunity to go on-site to the companies to help do assessments, policy development, and training. We realize we're a very small agency and there's only so much that we could do, so we've packaged all of these presentations, group activities, the PowerPoint presentations, and including the business plan of how you set up these programs. We put them into a CD-ROM and we just distribute them to community educators who want to do similar programs in their for their business community. It's all on a CD, and then we also do train-the-trainer programs to help people do this outreach.
Excellent. Thanks, Johnny. Now, Keisha, can you tell us about the work that you're doing with Johns Hopkins?
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I am a faculty member at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the School of Public Health. A lot of my work is on a policy, prevention policy, particularly related to the workplace. I do a lot of work in terms of epidemiology of injuries, of intentional and unintentional injuries, and how we can use science to really guide the policy formulation process. I bring to this job 6 years of experience working with a private company, helping them think about and develop some workplace policies. While most of my work has been in unintentional injuries, I think that there are definitely some lessons that we can apply to intentional injuries when we're thinking about workplace policies, about challenges with implementing policies, about enforcement, and also in terms of what do we need to think about to try to overcome some of the challenges. You know, people spend about 40% of their waking hours at work, and thinking about workplace policies that can be effective to deal with some of these issues that affect your everyday life is part of what I do.
That's great, and I think that leads us kind of to the first kind of item of broader discussion, Keisha. And maybe, Kim, we can go back to you first. If that makes sense. You know, earlier on, Liz and I mentioned the five norms and the ways they manifest themselves in a variety of workplaces, and the initial text chat of what could be different in workplaces really honed in on a lot of that. But do you have a sense of which pieces or which norms would be most important to address for primary prevention strategies in the workplace?
You know, there's the question of important, and there's the question of easier.
Uh-huh. So we're putting them together in any way.
Yes,
low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm all about the low-hanging fruit, because I think that, you know, that issue of of violence. People are very aware in the workplace about violence being impacting our lives and about that being something that we don't want in our communities and we don't want in our workplace and we don't want even, you know, the idea of even bullying. Although sometimes people don't see that in themselves, but that's a more tenable norm change. And I think also the privacy issue, trying to help people because of the enlightened self-interest issue, once we are able to help folks understand, as many people on this call so wisely do, the businesses that do this work understand that this is an enlightened self-interest issue. It is everybody's business, that it is an issue that does impact the bottom line. It impacts quality of life. It impacts the workplace. It impacts communities. It really, we're not talking about getting into somebody's business when they don't want you to, but we're talking about something that truly does bring itself into your workplace, so it is in your best interest to address it because of the cost, because of the health care issue, because of the turnover, because of the absenteeism, because of the potential workplace safety issues. That privacy issue and helping someone, not making someone, but helping someone, giving someone a variety of ways to reach out when they choose to be safe, is more tenable. The power issue, and traditional masculinity issues, I would say not as much. Limited roles for women, of women, I think because of the interest in corporate social responsibility that companies have and in trying to change, you know, the face of that, I think that's another low-hanging fruit.
That's great. I'd like to actually probe a little deeper. We'll come back to it because I want to turn to Johnny now. But I was really interested in the comments you made about bullying, and maybe that is a way to talk a little bit about the traditional masculinity and power. But first, Johnny, I know that Peace at Work, you know, really is seeking out innovative strategies to get to the roots of violence and prevent it before it starts. So what would you say about emerging models of prevention that maybe are addressing some of these norms?
Sure. Thank you, Larry. It is a challenge because these truly are emerging programs. There's very little evidence or evaluation on these contests that are being tried out. One idea is looking at sexual harassment. I just went through a sexual harassment training and was offered to go to another one. A lot of those are focusing in on liability and report procedures and seem to be written by attorneys for attorneys. But there's tremendous opportunity to look at issues of dominance, of male privilege, of control issues that can be incorporated into those trainings. One thing I want to mention is it's really, and for those of you all who've worked with schools, it's you could have the best content, we could have the best programs and put a lot of theory and evidence behind it, but the real trick is getting into the workplace, finding the time where it's not a matter of money or they believe in you, it's just trying to get in front of their employees. And sexual harassment trainings are mandatory, they're being done across the nation all the time, so that's one avenue. When you mentioned bullying, I want to reference just a great reference we have is Dr. Ruth and Gary Namby with the Bullying Institute. Their emphasis is on creating or on addressing the hostile environment, the bullying, manipulative entities that are in workplaces and are getting a lot of attention. We have employers wanting to do programs on bullying. And when you look at the concepts of bullying, we're finding a lot of the same issues that pervade domestic violence and sexual violence. Secrets, the privacy issues about manipulation, about dominance. And I think if we could help organizations address bullying, we could also be addressing bullying in the workplace. It could also extend down to their private lives.
Good, and maybe a little later I'd love also to talk about the links between bullying and sexual harassment and how they're similar and how they're different. And also the bullying resources you're mentioning. I think that we can get to people after the, you know, we can get all those resources to people. Why don't we make it a little bit even more complex now and look at this issue of organizational functions and...
I want to pose this particular question to Douglas because I know that a lot of work that you do has to do with organizational functions and you guys have done a lot of research on strategies in the workplace, and it seems that there's a big focus on personnel training. Now, I know that Blue Shield Against Violence does do extensive training. What I want to ask you is, what kinds of training have you found to be the most effective to support prevention of violence against women?
Douglas, you online?
Sorry. I think that many of the companies that we work with have at least an approach when we're talking directly about violence of some kind. So sexual assault, any of those issues, they have sort of protocols in place. What I think many don't realize is that the vast, vast majority of the issues that come up for victims in the workplace have nothing to do with visible violence, that there's the emotional, there's the lateness, there's the productivity, there's being at work and not being able to focus, all of those things. So what we're finding most effective over the last few years is really talking about the performance and performance management and working directly with the managers and those folks. So I'm trying to normalize it with all their other practices. Johnny mentioned just getting the time inside a company to deal with this is tough, and I find resistance sometimes with carving out a separate issue on this. But when we link it to performance and we talk about, in one sense, it doesn't really matter if all of these things come up, whether it's due to my having a new baby, an illness in the family, a new car that broke down, if I'm late, if my productivity's off, it has to be dealt with. So we say, let's just give you some more tools to deal with a person's performance.
So
and
really
then that seems
language.
To work. I'm sorry?
So you're really speaking the business's language and going right at what really matters to the business, as opposed to coming in kind of with this somehow a human service perspective.
Yeah, you know, I think that when we make some of the healthcare costs to them, it's such a contentious issue, and you can't really claim that you're going to lower healthcare costs, you know, maybe a tenth of 1% of a penny by dealing with this, because that's such a vast thing. But when we talk about the line manager and what people are dealing with daily, it seems to be more effective and more personal, if you will, to the business, because otherwise it's easy for them to turn around and go, I dispute your case here and there. But, yeah, talking about it that way, it seems to be more effective for us in getting them to let us come in and talk about this program. In fact, we work with Macy's, and they embed this training in their mandated sexual harassment training. So they've added an extra hour out here, so their required course actually has this as a piece. So they're doing it every 2 years.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks. Great.
Yeah, that really speaks to what Kim was talking about. I like how it's labeled enlightened self-interest. Now, this next question is for you, Keisha. I know that your expertise is in the feasibility of workplace strategies to prevent problems like violence. What I want to ask you is, what types of strategies do you see having a lot of traction? For example, what do you think would be the easiest to get implemented in workplaces and why?
What a great question, Liz. Thank you so much. You know, I'd say from my experience, one of the biggest challenges that I've encountered is how do you advance an issue like IPV to a company on their agenda? How do you make it their priority? And I just want to echo something that Douglas said a little while ago in terms of, and that Larry mentioned, is really speaking their language. What's the business case? A lot of times when you go in and you talk about the impact on productivity and things like absenteeism and presenteeism that Kim mentioned earlier, and you talk about the comorbidities that are related to IPV, when you talk about the impact of these things on the workforce, they tend to listen a bit more. I mean, we hope that people are altruistic in terms of wanting to do things in terms of prevention, but sometimes it really comes down to what's the business case here, what's the impact on the bottom line. And what we found is when we can actually use the data and really try to measure the impact, companies are going to listen to us more. I do have to say that it was extremely hard to get into the workplace to actually access that data, and it took my group a number of years to actually get to that point before we were able to do that. But now that we're in there, we're actually analyzing data, we're providing direction for policy formation, and this is also part of how do you change the culture of the workplace, where we can get to things like the norms in terms of dealing with privacy and power. And I think that's one of the bigger challenges that takes buy-in and really engagement from all levels of the workplace in terms of management and supervisors, employees, unions. Everybody needs to be on board with what you're trying to do and really coming down to changing the culture of the workplace where Violence is not acceptable.
It's interesting because Annie Jacoby was typing in that it's hard to get businesses to offer training. They shy away. And Marianne, I believe it was Green, talked about 8 million employee days a year lost due to domestic violence. And that's the kind of information that can be very, very persuasive, I think. We're currently doing some work with the state government and the governor in California where they're talking about health care reform, and we're talking about what about primary prevention. And since business pays so much of the fees for health care, productivity is turning out to be a very, very persuasive case, even with government, because they want to go to businesses and say, hey, we're going to be able to save you money. And so that maybe is another opportunity to really get to the primary prevention issues, which are so hard to get to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Exactly. Well, we're going to move the discussion into that direction right now. We're going to change the format a little bit, and this question is for all four of our guest speakers. You know, having just heard from each other and having had a little bit of time to reflect, most of the work that you've done or that you're doing has focused on the intervention side of prevention. From the experiences and observations that you have, what kinds of things do you think could have been in place in the workplace already to have reduced the chances that violence would have occurred in the first place?
Don't all answer at once.
One comment I'd like to make is many organizations, sort of a new, I don't know how new it is, emphasis for organizations is values. They're basing their companies and their mission statements on core character values. If I could speak, the best place I've ever worked was Outward Bound, and one of the core values we had was compassion, and they really emphasized empathy. And if we could take it from that angle where we're trying to demonstrate we want coworkers in our products and in the way we work together to have integrity, honesty, empathy, that, I believe, can lead to primary prevention.
That's an interesting thing. I'd love to hear the other speakers on this values question.
Well, I think that goes a little bit to, and it actually comes down to this, you know, they're a business. It's that enlightened self-interest issue. And thank you, Greta, for recognizing my face. That, you know, with the whole idea of values and corporate social responsibility, that we want this kind of compassionate workplace, this values-driven workplace, this workplace that cares about a green earth, that cares about the condition of workers in other parts of the world, that will not do this and will do this. And I think that part of that also comes down to, if we're going to have a violence-free workplace, we're also going to say, and this kind of person won't work here. You know, this, in a way, this really isn't primary prevention, but it's intriguing. L.L. Bean will not allow you to work any longer at their facility if you are even arrested for domestic violence. Mm-hmm. Not convicted, not indicted, arrested. And you are fully aware of this when you are hired. It's not necessarily primary prevention, and part of their screening is they screen very carefully. But we're talking about sort of, again, that social push for what we won't tolerate out of the people that work here. If you want to work for L.L. Bean, this is what we're norming for. This is what matters to us. And it's just kind of an interesting idea.
Absolutely. And this is Keisha. I want to add a point on to Kim. And, I mean, there are workplaces. I think that a workplace can say, you know, you are not allowed to use our company phone, fax machines, emails, time on the job, or property or resources to threaten or harass another person inside the workplace or outside the workplace. And if that occurs, certain reactions to that, certain things are going to happen. I think that's part of helping to change the culture, helping to sort of do things that are sort of really proactive. And I would argue that what Kim just mentioned is a type of primary prevention, because it's related to the hiring process that we talked a little bit about earlier.
You know, I think in addition to those things, there is one way that as the conversation has shifted from this being a personal, private home issue into a broader issue that I think is happening, I think more and more across the country, businesses are being aware of this, that there's a role, if they want to play in the social responsibility arena, there's one thing that businesses can do that nobody else can, and that's be a key player for economic security. And that's critical for any of the decisions that a woman is going to make to end the violence, to leave the violence, to stay and stop the violence, any of that stuff, that having economic security is something. So what I've talked to some businesses about is it's one thing to say, well, as part of our social responsibility, we're going to contribute to HIV/AIDS, or we're going to contribute to breast cancer, or we're going to contribute to something and own it and say, well, another role we can play is one that only a business can play, which is we will work towards having every employee have economic security so that they can make proper decisions about what they want to do. So not being afraid that if I come out as being a victim, if I have to make some changes in my schedule, if I perhaps need to leave, all of those things that the company's not going to jump on them, but it's going to say, yes, I understand, and we're happy to work with you on this.
Yeah.
I think there's an opportunity there as well.
Yeah, I think so, and it would be interesting to talk because a lot of what you just described really isn't primary prevention. It's how to protect women after the fact, but some of it obviously also is kind of before the fact. Kim, I wanted to ask you kind of off the record because we're a very small group here, so nobody will share this. what percentage of corporations do you think really care about this values issue and really kind of buy into it as opposed to care about the profit issue and care about values just if it's kind of fits with their profit motivation?
Oh, most all of them care because it fits with their profit motivation.
Uh-huh.
It's enlightened self-interest. They're there to make money.
Uh-huh.
But you can do well by doing good.
So there are ways.
So that's okay.
There are ways we need to link this very clearly with enlightened self-interest.
Of course.
And make the argument stronger.
And the other way this works, you know, we've been chatting and it's been really interesting, is the way we sort of talk about it is business case human face. Because one of the things that we've really noticed, and I think this will just really hearten everybody, is when there are CEOs who have the business case, but then they have the human face. They know somebody who's an employee or they recognize it in their workplace, that really changes things for them. They connect those numbers with, oh, and then that happened to so-and-so, like what Douglas was sharing, or, oh, that I see that with such and such a person, and that just makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you say, what can they do primary prevention, we should look at the work that's been done with the immediate health issues. Why did companies decide to take on health and food in the cafeterias or walking clubs or all those things, paying for gym memberships? Wasn't done in, I think, most cases because they thought, wow, let's just take some of our profits and let people have gym memberships. It's because they knew that by helping people stay healthy, they got more work out of them. I mean, I'm somewhat cynical about myself and others as business people. And I think when we can do the same thing for this and say, look, messages you put out about partner violence are going to help and keep employees here, retention becomes a better issue so that they do it, and it's not just with your employees, but helping that message get to the wider community will help you as a business. So if we can take some, borrow some models, and I know Keisha can speak to this, from the work that's been done around health and preventative medicine and keeping employees healthy, I think we can use the exact same thing with the issue of violence against women and domestic violence.
Right, what a great segue, Douglas. I was getting to that point, particularly when we think about employee assistance programs, which we know a number of workplaces have in this country, particularly about 60 to 70% of workplaces have some sort of EAP, where they are focusing on wellness, on the big thing right now is obesity prevention, physical activity, nutrition. And so if we think about how to really build on EAPs and having EAPs encourage healthy relationships, conflict resolution, I mean, these are things that can also contribute to dealing with the norms that we talked about earlier.
It's interesting. Elizabeth just typed into the chat that in a lot of cases, employees don't know about the EAPs or maybe they're hesitant to use them because of confidentiality issues. And I think a lot of that can be straightened out pretty straightforwardly by looking at some orientation, also looking at some of the EAP design issues. So that might be a piece to talk again. But someone asked a really good question, what is an EAP? And that's an employee assistance program, which is to say it's really, in effect, some kind of a counseling or support program, which in many cases are offered. Traditionally, they related to alcohol and drug problems, but clearly they go far beyond that. And you know, are often set up with a wall of confidentiality.
Right.
So the employer doesn't need to know about it.
Right, and as mentioned too, right now one of the top issues for EAPs is dealing with the work-life balance. And it's clear, I think, to a number of people, I think, on this call, or I hope I'm not being too presumptuous to say that, this issue of violence against women in ICV is a work-life issue, and it spills over into the workplace.
Yeah, and I just want to be sure that there have been a couple of places where we've spilled over much more into the secondary, tertiary prevention. Clearly that's important, and clearly there's been more pioneering work done in that area. The issues of how to deal with the violence before it occurs, what should be occurring in the workplace first, in some ways are even more challenging, and what we're trying to hone in on as much as possible.
Exactly. And I mean, one of the things that I've noticed too is that, you know, in talking about what's going on and promising workplace strategies, you've all touched on things that need to be in place in workplaces already to prevent violence against women. What I want to ask now is, before we go into opening this up to everyone else, I'd like to ask our guest speakers, given the types of strategies that you've just been discussing and some of the things that we're reading in the text chat, what do you think is needed to overcome the challenges? For example, how do we get into workplaces? I mean, and we talked a lot about the enlightened self-interest. What are some other strategies that would be effective, or what's needed to get to that level of primary prevention?
And why don't we start with Johnny, because Johnny, I think you had an idea of technological intervention as part of this.
Thank you. I want to first say that it really does not help address the norms, that we're not changing attitudes and beliefs. But we can look at, when we look at sort of primary prevention about organizational governance interventions, this isn't my idea. I stole it from Jeff DeYoung from the National Victim Bar Association. But everyone's been in hotels, and remember when you got a key, like a hard metal key, and it switched over to being a card, like a credit card that you swipe. Many of the reasons why that occurred was due to lawsuits of sexual assaults that are occurring in hotels. And even though we're not getting rid of the perpetrator's motives, we are creating safer workplaces, or safer the workplace of the hotels and motels, by having a technological intervention, not allowing people to make copies of those, or they drop and they lose it. It's removing the setting where these events occur.
Thank you, Johnny. What are some of the other answers to Liz's question? How do we go a little deeper in terms of specific strategies?
How do we achieve these strategies?
Well, then let's open it, since there's no immediate answer. Let's open it up both to answer that question in terms of some ideas that we've got, according to my list, 157 different telephones on the line, which probably means about 250 or 300 people participating. Let's open it up. In addition to text chatting, feel free to raising your hand, and we'll ask the operator to open your line. If you'd like to make some comments by text chat, please do so. But it's always more fun when we hear from people. So just raise your hands over there on the top left of your screen. Just click on that. While we're waiting, I want to just kind of encourage people to make sure you've opened that you're looking at your text chat. But we've got one hand raised. Could you please, operator, open Galen Pack's line? Operator, are you on?
Yes, one moment.
Great, thank you very much.
No problem.
And would other people who have comments, please raise your hands as well. Comments, questions for the panel? Any thoughts about what's realistic that we're discussing, what's too hard?
Mm-hmm. What have you heard that particularly resonates with you?
Pardon me, Galen Pack, your line is now open.
Thank you. I work for the Marion County Sheriff's Office in Salem, Oregon. I'm a former executive director of domestic violence shelters, and also a former police officer. Now I run a program called Children of Incarcerated Parents.
Uh-huh.
And one of the issues that we deal with in incarcerated parents, particularly in women, is we find that domestic violence plays a big part in why they are incarcerated. And so when I came and I discovered that, you know, I had a captive audience, so to speak, we decided to do an educational program for our female inmates about domestic violence, how to help them identify it, and also to show them or help them identify what healthy relationships look like. But when we started developing the curriculum for this, one of the things we realized right off the bat was that we needed to do a training with the corrections officers so that they would be able to respond appropriately to inmates who had issues around domestic violence or who had issues as a result of attending the training. And when we did the training with our corrections officers, we found that a lot of our female officers were victims of domestic violence as well. And some of them, of course, we had a variety of response. Some of them didn't want to attend the training because they didn't want to relive their own victimization.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some who, you know, were really glad that we were doing this and really felt validated by this. So it was a very interesting response by our corrections officers as well as by the inmates who really appreciate the information.
That's great, and I guess that's one key venue. You know, we've had, if I remember correctly, when David asked the one of the initial chat questions, or it's not called the chat, I forgot what it's called, but the polling questions, it seemed like there were a lot of people online from colleges. And we've kind of, you know, been talking a lot about traditional businesses, and now you're talking about incarceration. I'm wondering what rings true. If there are people here from colleges, and we'll hear first if, operator, if you can open Kate Parker's line, but then Renata Klein and other people from colleges, and a little bit about how this rings true. Clearly, that's an early opportunity to change norms. Another side of workplaces, of course, is recruitment, and there might be things that people go in asking or expecting, which start to then define workplaces so that they can hire in the appropriate way. So why don't we, if we can hear from Kate Parker first, if her line is open, then Renata, and then any other people from colleges for a minute, we'd love to hear from them.
Kate Parker, your line is now open.
And after Renata, please open Sean Murphy's line.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Kate Parker. I'm calling from the Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, where I'm the Prevention and Training Coordinator. The last question may not necessarily be related to my question. I just was thinking about, and it's more of a concept or an idea, is we're looking at models that support victims in the workplace. I'm wondering about models and strategies about preventing offending behavior beyond a value statement that's used in a workplace. How, and if there are any kind of programs that are holding and looking at holding coworkers accountable and looking at pro-offending attitudes within the workplace, and strategies to prevent that instead of the dual focus of looking at both supporting victims but also holding offenders accountable within our workplace. Thank you.
So this is Douglas. Can I chime in for a second?
Yes, please.
You know, it's a tough one, and that's where we get into the norms, I think, around what is acceptable and non-acceptable behavior. But most workplaces, you have rules about uses of company property, company time. So if somebody's doing that kind of behavior, it probably falls very, very squarely under the rule of being unacceptable behavior, unacceptable use of company property. And then I think that what makes it tough is it's similar to some of the early discussions around sexual harassment. The people were uncomfortable saying that's not a funny joke, or I don't like that that statement. And I think that has to be modeled and be encouraged by executives, because people are afraid sometimes to confront the bully. They're afraid to confront the person who might be making jokes about their spouse and the way they're behaving. So I think that that's a tougher one. And the place to start is a policy that says we don't put up with this, and use of company property is restricted, and a very low tolerance level for that kind of, you know, immediate report of and final warning if somebody does that is an initial approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're working also on prevention with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and that's come up there as a policy as well. and an interesting collaboration. We want to hear from Renata next, and after that, operator, if you can open up Sean Murphy's line. Also, Elizabeth Patel, I'd like you to talk to us about the improv group Sex Signals, if you'd be willing. And then operator Beth Malkus and Leslie Coghill, and Elizabeth Tandis Raves as well. So why don't we hear first from Renata? Is it? Am I pronouncing your name right, Renata?
Yes, you do.
Thanks.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling from the University of Maine.
Excellent.
University of Maine last year in September 2006 implemented a new policy, a workplace employee policy, that specifically addresses the impact of intimate partner violence on the workplace. And this was following a similar initiative in state government in Maine and at the Attorney General's office, where all state government organizations, agencies implemented similar policies on intimate partner violence in the workplace. And I have sort of one question and one comment on this. And the comment is that in doing these, in developing the policies and then in having fairly extensive trainings of our employees in state government and at the university and training a large number of people really to recognize warning signs and to learn how to approach a person, how to validate an experience, how to make good referrals and so forth. We also found that lots of people, that the opening the conversation on intimate partner violence also provided room to address other issues in the workplace, in particular around bullying and abuse of supervisors. And I think that's an important connection to keep in mind. And my question is right now is that I'm right now in the process of trying to a little more formally evaluate the effectiveness of this workplace intervention, those kinds of policies combined with employee training. And if any of the participants to this web conference right now, if you're aware of empirical evaluations of this kind of intervention, I would really appreciate if you could get in touch with me and let me know about them. And maybe I can type my email into the chat box, and then you could get in touch with me. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Next, I think we had Sean Murphy on the line. Is his line open?
I believe so. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, Sean.
Hi. I work at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania. I'm a student employee under the Haven Project. And what I wanted to know, and this takes a second to ask, how do we essentially balance the idea of censorship, intervention, and awareness at the same time planting a seed of social normalization without losing credibility and respect from the individual? In other words, if we have a perp or if we have an individual who is problematic, how do we address them without diminishing their rights to speak, but at the same time addressing the needs of our business and our coworkers?
Yeah, maybe if we can hear from one of the panelists about that, and I really want to, you know, kind of emphasize at the same time how do we best shape this in terms of today's discussion, which is explicitly about primary prevention. We know that's really, really hard, but thinking not just about the problems after they arise, but what can be done to prevent the problems in the first place.
Well,
any panelists want to speak?
Yeah, this is Kim. I think that's a good question, but I think when we're talking about primary prevention and specifically in terms of, you know, intimate partner violence, there are so many issues related to freedom of expression, but when we're talking specifically about issues related to this issue and power and control and silence and privacy, I think it behooves us to start out and say this is what is and is not acceptable in this workplace related to how we treat other people, how we threaten other people. You know, this is in our society, we want a healthy workplace, we want healthy employees, and this will not be tolerated. This is pretty clear. And, you know, I think the other, Sean, and I think you said it really well, the really other important side of it, and I saw this a lot in the chat, it isn't just one time you say this to one person. I do this all the time, and we were in an employee group, and I was explaining how sometimes a person who's a victim of intimate partner violence might be your overachiever. They might be the most incredible employee that you ever had, and I had a manager say, well, but how am I supposed to know who they are? I said, you're not. You're supposed to be giving the messages all the time in your workplace, communicating in as many avenues as you can, that in our workplace culture, it is important to us that people are safe, healthy, happy, and well. If you're not, if you need help, here's some of the signs. This is what you can do. If you see some of these signs in yourself that you might be abusive, this is where you can get help. So that you're sending those messages both ways. At the same time, you're saying, this won't be tolerated. You're also saying, but before you might get there, this is what we can do for you. And I hope that with the same dignity and respect that we would help somebody who's a potential victim, we would help somebody that's a potential abuser. And I think those are the important messages that you give.
Thanks, Kim, so much. And someone sent me a private chat and said, well, if you're talking about primary prevention, bring it back to norms change. And, you know, use the term workplace culture, which is exactly the right term when we're thinking about norms change. Can we hear next from Beth? Beth Malkus, is your line open? Operator, could you open her line, please? And while we're waiting, Leslie Cotthill, is your line open? We have the operator on the line?
Yes, give me a moment.
Okay. And how about Elizabeth Patel? Do we have her line open yet?
Yes, one more.
Okay. Why don't we hear from anyone? Whoever's line is open of the three of you, please speak.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Vitel.
Oh, good. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but your message was so interesting, and I was hoping it was checked private by mistake, and you'd be willing to share with us.
Yeah, no, well, I didn't know if everyone was interested, but I'm glad that you are, and this is in no way a commercial endorsement, but the Sex Signals is actually a for-profit group, but they what they do is they go to campuses around the country, and they do it sort of a modified improv that's audience-fed, and it takes on situations where frat party kind of stuff, and it really, really engages the audience. I think Kim Wells may have seen it, and it's kind of, in sense of primary prevention, I think it's an extremely early strategy, because a lot of the young men who attend these performances really don't think that they recognize their own behavior, and they really never thought that it was predatory. So it's really fascinating and very powerful early thing, and I think anyone who's out there, so many from universities, should be aware of it.
Thanks so much. That's really valuable. We just have a couple of minutes left. I'm wondering whether Beth, is your line now open?
Hello.
Hi, Beth.
Hi. I'm just going to tell people, you know, we've been having this discussion in Ohio with sexual assault and domestic violence programs, that we ourselves don't have policies on domestic violence for our employees. And I guess that was my main message, is that recognize that, you know, we can go out and tell employers to have this, but we ourselves don't have that. We don't have a leg to stand on. And I also want to say is that to get a policy in place in an organization, specifically like we have worked here, it took us 3 years to get a policy at the Department of Health. And it's taken us another 3 years to get another policy to present to the state of Ohio. But it takes a lot of work and perseverance.
Thank you. We have time for one more comment, and this is Leslie Coggett on the line.
One moment, please. Leslie, your line is now open.
Hi, this is Leslie. I need to ask a question on behalf of someone else, so I'm going to read it. My question is, direct service organizations are taxed, and what little prevention programming occurs is focused on schools and youth. Besides helping us even get the doors open for us, how can we get corporate partners involved in conducting these trainings?
Great question.
Any of our panelists want to take this question?
Well, I found, this is Douglas, I've found more and more for the last few years when I go in and work, employees want to know, well, this is great, but what do we have for our children, for our sons and daughters? So I think that if you're approaching primary prevention, that I think one first way to get in is going to be able to talk to employees about their families and what their children are going through, and you bring up some of the stats around teen dating violence and abuse of technology, that you might get a ready ear from the company, especially if the employee groups that want that, to start with that.
Great. Thank you. Well, we're just about out of time here, and before we move into closing comments and the evaluation, I just really want to extend a big, big thank you to all of our guest panelists and to all of you. We've heard a lot of different strategies today. I mean, some of them we've also talked about some of the challenges to these, getting these strategies implemented, but I think that when we think about primary prevention, we have to remember just how difficult it is. And when we're talking about changing norms, changing workplace cultures, changing environments, this is something that we're all working at from a variety of levels. And it's just really wonderful to hear that there's so many people who are interested in moving this particular discussion and this field forward. I'm going to turn this over to Larry right now, but again, I just want to thank all of you for joining us for an incredible discussion today.
Yeah, and I loved hosting with you, Liz. It's a lot of fun. I do agree this is very challenging. Just off the top of my head, a couple of kind of key elements that came up today was the notion of really working with organizations and businesses on the issue of values and kind of tying that in to enlightened self-interest. I think that brought up the third point, which is that we do have some data related to cost, related to productivity, and that's an incredible tool to use and also something that we probably want to invest in enhancing and advancing and collecting in different kinds of ways. A lot of questions came up about the bullying issue. Is it a way to look at harassment? I noticed some text chats, and I have to say that I'm very, very good at multitasking, but I always find it challenging to keep up with this incredibly interesting text chat at the same time that we're having this oral conversation. And I'm glad we've got a record, David, of the text chat. Thank you, you know, for providing that.
Technology and techno innovation.
Yeah. And just finally, a lot of issues also came up on training and education. As Annie Jacoby just summed up in a note at the bottom of text chat, we have tons to do, but I hope that others like me found this a really kind of constructive place to start to move ahead just a bit further. Great panelists. Thank the four of you so much. You really added so much value for me today to what I learned, and I think I'm speaking for virtually everyone. So why don't we turn it back to you, David? We're just about out of time, and it would be helpful if we could get a brief evaluation before the end. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. This is I really want to thank all of you for the conversation today. On your screen, you should see an evaluation for the session. Please complete this evaluation and highlight some of the of how this does. We do look at this as we design future Prevention Connection web conferences. The text chat from today's session and the slides from the session will be posted on Prevent Connect's website, www.preventconnect.org. And so also if you have any policies that you want us to post on the site or links to your things, include that in the text chat, and then we can share this with other participants. I'd like to really thank all of you for this discussion. I find this a challenging discussion to be able to think about the primary prevention in workplaces. Yesterday I was reading in the paper about companies are giving up head meters to encourage people to walk. If what can companies be able to do to be able to encourage healthy relationships and sexual respect? That's what we need to be able to see to be able to create a world without violence against women. So I'd like to thank all of our presenters, Keisha, Kim, Johnny, and Douglas. I'd like to thank Liz and Larry for leading the conversation, and also Greta from Prevention Institute, along with Amy and Ellen and Chad from CalCASA for today's conference. So what we will be doing is, if you want to make any last comments, go ahead and put them in the text chat and share that. We will be fill out the evaluation, and we encourage you to join us at other Prevention Connection events over the that we will be having. This will include that we will be having a next web conference on September 19th, and that this will be opening up very shortly. So thank you very much. This will conclude the audio portion of today's web conference. Speakers stay on the line to go into a post-session conference.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.